Hello, everybody, and welcome to this, the latest episode of the Rewatch Project with Hannah and Mike. I am Mike, and with me, as always, is Hannah. How the heck are you this evening, Hannah?
Well, that is correct. We have not pod-faded. We are still here.
We've life-faded, but we haven't pod-faded.
So, Mike went to the UK, then came back with a gift with no receipt.
A venereal disease.
He came back with COVID, and he's only gone and passed it on to me.
Yes.
He is now testing negative, and I am still a positive petunia.
You are. That's what I call you.
Positive petunia.
Yeah. So we both have COVID. So that is another reason why we haven't recorded for a while. But under Hannah's urging, so you can thank or blame Hannah, depending on how this goes, that we are recording tonight.
I was very much of the fact of, fuck it, why not?
Yeah.
You know, so sorry if that's a bit of a half-assed approach, but that's the approach I'm going for.
Yeah, we'll see. And I think Twin Peaks might lend itself to being watched in a semi-fevered state. So
we'll be fine.
We will see how that goes. But speaking of which, Hannah, what episode of Twin Peaks are we covering this evening? Please tell us about it.
I'm just making sure I've got the right one up. I have. Tonight's episode is called Cooper's Dreams. The synopsis says, Cooper and company have tea with the log lady, who tells them there was a third man following Leo and Jacques the night Laura died. At Jacques Renault's cabin, Cooper, Hawk and Truman find Waldo the bird.
And this is the sixth episode.
Okay, cool. It's directed by Leslie Linker Glatter.
Yeah.
And written by Mark Frost.
Awesome, Leslie Linker Glatter, another indie filmmaker. A lot of female directors on Twin Peaks, which I don't think was terribly usual at the time. It does feel quite like...
No, you tell me. You look like you were expecting me to answer that.
I think it's fair to say that Twin Peaks is quite a gender agnostic show in many ways. A lot of people do accuse David Lynch sometimes of misogyny. I think because he does a lot of films about women in trouble. But I mean, without getting, you know, kicking that rock over too much, I just don't think that David Lynch sees the world and art's place in the world the same way that the rest of us do. And I think I would caution people from trying to apply the rules in the same way to David Lynch that you would, hell, even Mark Frost or Joss Whedon or Chris Carter or any of those people. I just don't think that he thinks of characters even really as people as much as ciphers and symbols. And
I don't know if I agree with that as much, but I do agree in terms of people he collaborates. I don't think he sees gender. I think he sees their vision.
There's a famous quote from him.
Their skill and what they can bring out of what he's trying to tell.
There's a great quote. This isn't a direct quote. There's a great paraphrase of him when Twin Peaks The Return came out in 2017, and somebody said to him, you know, hey, lots of people on Twitter are talking about the treatment of women in The Return. What do you think about that? And he just literally was like, I do not know what any of what you said means. It's like they may as well have just been speaking a different language for him to be able to relate to. So I think that that's a bit of a tricky one. Cool. Okay. Well, before we get into that, just a couple of little bits of housekeeping. Reminder that we appreciate feedback at rewatchprojectpodcast@gmail.com or through the comment section on our YouTube channel. And also we are on Twitter and Instagram. In both cases, we are at rewatchproj. Please check out our friend shows, namely Chinstroker vs. Punter, his film, Her Movie, Film Bastards, Video Game Landfill, The Good, The Bad and The Odd, and the Talk Without Rhythm podcast. And also we really appreciate reviews on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or whatever your podcaster of choice is. Do we have any feedback, Hannah?
We do. Okay. We have an email entitled Twin Peaks Rewatch.
Okay.
Hello, Mike and Hannah. Jackie from LA here. I am a new listener to your podcast, specifically your Twin Peaks episodes. I am loving watching the show again, and unbelievably, I have not watched it since it first aired. I remember being mesmerised by it, but have been a little scared to go back and watch it in case it did not stand up to my memory of it. I am very relieved to say it does. I'm also relieved to hear you are covering the film and the sequel show, as I have seen neither, and it gives me an excuse to do so. Looking forward to Mike getting back so you and I can continue the rewatch. Hannah mentioned Babylon 5 in the last episode, and I have to ask, could that be your next rewatch? I really need to revisit that too. Keep up the great work, Jackie.
And Jackie's from
LA.
LA. I don't think I've ever had feedback on any podcast I've ever done from somebody from LA, so that might be a first.
Welcome, Jackie.
Welcome, Jackie. Yeah, so, I mean, it's funny, I do see people who watch the original Twin Peaks and then never saw the film or the TV show, or have gone back to watching it, you know, a little trepidatious, wondering whether it's going to stand up or not. But what I will say is, at least those people who are going back to it now have got, like, beautiful, high-definition versions of it to watch, yeah, as opposed to the dog shit VHS copies that we had for the longest time.
I've only seen the what are you going to call it, sequel show, once. So I thought you'd seen it more. I thought you'd watched it again. So I'm interested in how much I've remembered. And the bits that stick in my mind that I think about whenever someone says the third season of Twin Peaks, these are the things that come up in my brain.
Yeah.
Like, how much of a big part are they actually on rewatch?
I always think, when people mention the return, I always think of the musical sequences in the Roadhouse at the end of the episodes. That's one of the things
that my mind goes to. Yeah, that's not for me. I mean, I'm not going to talk about them here because, not that it's a spoiler as such, but I'd prefer to talk about it in the episode.
Yeah.
But it's a bit like when we covered Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. In the third season, I remember talking about the portion of it when Simmons is on the other planet, you know, and they're trying to rescue her, whatever. I think I remember saying in the episode, the first time I watched that through, I remember that being for a much longer period of time.
Yeah.
And it's on rewatch, it was over and done with so quickly. Yeah. And it will be interesting to see if that same thing happens.
Well, the other thing as well is that when we watched The Return, we were doing a rewatch of the original series before The Return, but we ran out of time.
Yeah.
We misjudged it, and then as the series started, when we were about 2/3 of the way through the second season. But with hindsight, now knowing what I know, having seen The Return, it really should have been Fire Walk With Me that we watched before watching The Return. Because that's the thing, that's the Twin Peaks that it references the most.
Yeah, and we'll probably do it in that order.
Yeah, well, it's release time anyway. Order.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It will be really interesting. I'm really pleased to hear from you, Jackie. Thank you for sending your email in.
Cool. Always good to hear.
In terms of Babylon 5, that's definitely on our list of rewatch projects.
Yeah. Well, I always thought it was funny. I when I was feeling ill the other day, I had a real hankering to watch some Babylon 5 because it's a bit of a comfort show for me.
Yeah.
And I downloaded it and was about to start watching it, just sort of, you know. But then when I was searching for it online, I saw that it's actually getting a Blu-ray release for the first time ever quite soon. So it'll be coming out for the first time ever in beautiful quality.
Right.
So I don't know. I mean, I feel kind of like we're probably almost due for a Babylon 5 rewatch anyway.
Yeah.
So maybe.
Well, I mean, that has always been something we've said that we do.
Yeah, we've never rewatched it, have we?
No. I mean, we've started to, but then, you know, other things have got in the way. It's on the list.
Yeah.
Definitely on the list, along with many other things.
You know what else is on the list? Twin Peaks. Shall we hit pause, watch this?
All right, Mr. Cheese.
Okay, so what's the episode, Mrs. Cheese? What's it called?
No, remember, I'm positive Petunia.
Sorry.
The episode is called Cooper's Dreams.
Cooper's Dreams. Okay, so we're going to hit pause. We're going to watch the episode and I'm going to come back and tell you what our reactions to it are. So speak to you shortly.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, and welcome to Film Bastards, a podcast where three friends, two of them married and two of them podcasting life partners, chat everything from new releases, trailers, news, and an eclectic mix of other film goodies. Oh, and many, many, many tangents. You can find them by searching your podcast provider or check them out on Twitter and Instagram by searching Film Bastards. You never know, you might like it. And if you don't, well, we don't really give a f***.
And we are back. So we have just finished watching Cooper's Dreams, the sixth episode of Twin Peaks. Any initial thoughts, Hannah, before we break it on down?
Break it down.
Break it down.
I thought it was interesting how they kind of set it up like the pilot, in a way, with the noisy foreign group in the hotel. But it obviously it's the middle of the night.
Well, I almost wonder if at one point, and this does kind of become a thing at a certain point, that the outsiders coming in for something at the hotel was designed to be part of the show.
Yeah.
Like you get later on, there's a it's not really a spoiler because it's a silly little thing. There's like this convention of people, and it's never explained, but it's loads of people in naval uniforms bouncing tennis balls and they've taken over the hotel, so it's almost as though it's part of the flavor of the show was this idea that they're going to every few episodes bring in this new group of odd people for something at the hotel.
I do like how it kind of gives a flavor of being sort of in a slightly off kilter Groundhog Day.
Yeah,
the same things are happening, the same nefarious things are happening with different characters.
Yeah. And this whole idea...
And that theme goes throughout. And like you, obviously, you don't see that at the start, but as it unfolds and you see that Leo Johnson and...
Hank.
The off-kilter Groundhog Day thing being like you've got a different set of foreign... a different foreign group...
Yeah.
In the hotel, there's still like dodgy dealings, untruths going on. So Audrey is the one going to be at the perfume counter rather than Laura. You've got Madeline living at the Palmer House, not Laura.
Yeah.
You've got Leo Johnson and Hank. You find out that there's a relationship there and Leo has taken over from Hank. Much to Hank's disgust.
You also see that there's an additional level of subterfuge in the whole Josie, Ben, Catherine.
Yeah,
thing
absolutely.
Well.
Seeing that Josie, you know, there are more villainous layers to her than you first realise, and she's not this naive, innocent
who
character.
Who can barely speak English.
Yeah.
Doesn't know what shenanigans means.
Exactly. She's playing a part herself. It just adds another layer to the onion of mystery, I suppose. And this episode just, I suppose why, hopefully the episode doesn't sound like this, but when Mike first asked me what I thought of the episode, I found it very hard to put that into words, partly because my brain is mush, but also it's hard to sort of quantify those things initially. It feels like a familiar episode, but not.
We're moving into a phase in the show where the narrative is really starting to take hold. So it's not like the episodes now don't have something that obviously defines them as an episode. So you don't have like earlier episodes where it was the funeral episode or the rock throwing in the woods episode.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say that for me, the... I'll explain what this means in a moment, but the eye of the duck scene in this episode for me very much is the into the night sequence in the woods. It's a term I'll be using quite a bit moving forward, but it's a David Lynch term. And have you ever heard the phrase Eye of the Duck, the Eye of the Duck scene? What do you know what that means?
Yes, but explain it.
Okay. I mean, basically what it is it's a sequence that exists at a point where it wouldn't make any sense if it existed anywhere else. So it comes from the idea that if you're doing a painting of a duck, if you get the eye in just the wrong place, the whole energy of the image is gone. Why it's a duck, I don't know, but that's what David does. So, and he always says that everything that he does has an Eye of the Duck sequence, a sequence which, you know, you could say is the defining sequence or the sequence that makes it all kind of hang together. And I find that most things that David Lynch does, and most episodes of Twin Peaks, even though not all of them are directly, you know, created by David Lynch, have an Eye of the Duck sequence. Mm. And I would say that, so for example, I would say that in the pilot episode, the Eye of the Duck sequence is probably the Sarah Palmer crying down the phone scene. Yeah. I'd say that, you know, the funeral sequence was one. The rock throwing in the woods is another one. And I would say that in this episode, it's the, you know, it's the sequence where they're basically the whole run of scenes across them finding the log lady's cabin and them finding Leo's abandoned cabin.
I was going to say that just when you were saying how the first episode is, you know, the death, and then this one, you know, one episode's the funeral, one's the rock throwing.
Yeah. And that's not the case now, really. It's
no.
Just, it's the next episode.
And I was about to say that I had, I sort of thought that that didn't happen until further through. Mm. We are actually only two from the end of season one.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a very short season.
Yeah, yeah. But I sort of forget that. I think there's a lot more, because there's a lot more in season two.
Yeah.
I think I expected there to be the one thing that defines an episode.
I think that's why it's beyond saying I really liked it and then breaking the episode down and looking at specific moments. It's a difficult episode to reconcile critically in an encapsulation, because A, we've both got COVID, and B, it does nothing to holistically define the episode.
To be honest, I think for me personally, you can take as read that I enjoy all of the episodes. Yeah. There are elements that I enjoy less than others.
And there are some episodes that soar,
yeah.
I think.
But I think it should be taken as read that I enjoy all of Twin Peaks.
Unless you say otherwise.
So I think from here forward, I'm not going to be saying if I liked it or didn't like it.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I'm just going to go into
what you liked about
what
it.
I liked what about worked. It. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, should we do that?
You go for it.
In the spirit of that. So we open up with the Icelanders waking Cooper up. And I think the other, you talk about the cyclical nature of the show. And I think part of this is comes from the idea of the soap opera. You know, I've talked before about how the soap opera as a storytelling mechanic resists closure. You know, it's like very few people, you know, remember how Dynasty or Dallas ended, because it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, and that's the thing with Twin Peaks.
The process rather than the end game.
Yeah, is that you can finish watching Twin Peaks and just go back to the beginning. You know, it's not, there's no end. You know, I mean, technically Twin Peaks has three endings, but it really has none. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it's just a question of where you choose. I always think of the line from The Dark Knight, you know, is it better to die a hero or live long enough to become a villain?
Mm.
You know, and about how happy endings are just where you've chosen to stop telling the story, because who's to say that when Snow White goes off with the prince, he doesn't turn out to be an abusive bastard. But the story has ended with them going off to live happily ever after, as far as we know.
Mm.
And I think that Twin Peaks is never going to end or have an ending.
Well, it doesn't give you those bold final claims, yeah, like, and everything was fine with this person from here on out. You know, it really does just give you a snapshot of where they are at the moment that you meet them.
Yeah, and it's like another great example of that is, and this has changed a lot now. It's like if you look at a show like Lost, a lot of people kicked off because they thought that the final episode of that show was disappointing. And it's like, well, that's because it should never have had an ending. That show should have just, it would have been great if it had just got cancelled.
Yeah.
And you never found out, you know, and it preserved the mystery and the purity of the idea.
I never invested my time in it, so I don't feel that strongly about the ending. But I have friends who have.
Yeah.
I'm furious about it.
But my view of that is, does you not liking the ending diminish the enjoyment you had of watching the show whilst it's on? Because that enjoyment still happened.
Yeah, but I can understand, you know, having enjoyment with a view to having questions answered. And I know there are things that I watch and enjoy knowing that there's going to be a conclusion to events.
Yeah.
And when that doesn't happen, that's wholly frustrating. I mean,
another great example of that, a very current one for us, is The X-Files. The X-Files is a show and movies where, God, The X-Files has had about 5 endings.
Mm.
And the most recent ending is just the most recent ending. It's only the ending in the sense that they haven't made any more yet since then.
Yeah.
And there'll probably be another 3 endings. It's a question of why you watch stuff. But then again, it's with The X-Files, every episode has an ending. It's had 300 endings.
I think as much as Twin Peaks has a lot of surreal elements that, you know, obviously more that are yet to come, in terms of alternative ways of looking at things.
Yeah, genre.
I think it's probably the most true to life in the sense that when one person leaves this earth, you know, passes away, whether it's naturally or by force, that someone takes their place and the same things happen in this and more experiences are there. It doesn't mean you don't remember those people, but life carries on.
Yeah.
You know, the world keeps turning.
And also, and that's where I think theology comes from, this idea that there are larger forces as well. You know, I think it's part of that. But
it does sort of talk to the equal parts of being significant and really insignificant, which sounds a bit deep Tuesday evening.
But you see how death affects people's lives and all of these things. But it's interesting because going back to this circular thing, one of the things that you see is that the bit with the beginning with the Icelanders is very reminiscent of the first 1-hour episode where you see Cooper hanging upside down, updating Diane.
Yeah.
Of course, this is a Diane call.
Mm-hmm.
I've realised that the two things that I quote the most in my life are probably Twin Peaks and The Simpsons, where to the point where I quote them so often that I even forget that I'm quoting them. It's just become part of my language.
What's The Simpsons one?
There's hundreds in The Simpsons. Right. I can't even begin to
list them. I miss all of them.
Devil's Advocate, you know, there's millions. But the one that in this scene that I always think of is when Cooper's talking about how when you travel, you almost lose the ability to control one's environment.
Yeah.
You know, that's something that I often think about. And he talks to Diane about how he gives you a little bit of history as well about working in New York and the earplugs and all that kind of stuff. But of course, as the audience, we haven't got, a clue what's going on here. But we see Audrey attempts to speak to him, and he warns her that he's feeling a little bit on edge. But she talks about how she's got a job and she wants to help him. But because he's on edge, because he hasn't slept, he sort of pushes her away, and that will have consequence as the show goes on. I love the fact that they keep upping the ante of the ridiculousness of the food stuff with Jerry. Like, you've had the baguettes. There's a fun bit of business coming up soon with a pig-shaped piece of cheese. But then in this, we've got the giant leg of lamb that he just whacks down on his desk.
Yeah, which does happen to be my leg of beef for the episode for a couple of reasons.
Okay.
Firstly, how far has he transported that with just some glad wrap around the main part and the bone exposed? Because there was no wrapping around that bone.
Yeah, well, only from the room, presumably.
But presumably...
He was gifted it, wasn't he?
He was gifted it. Was it frozen when it was given to him?
Oh, I thought so. They probably kept it in the Great Northern kitchen, didn't they?
Some explanation would have been good. Where did he put it?
Oh, this is Twin Peaks. You can't apply that logic to him.
Where did he put it?
But he...
Was it served at the party they had?
We get a lot of great crazy Leland in this episode, like when he tries to return to work. I feel like that's me with COVID on a Zoom call. I'm fine. I can do this. He talks about how he needs to occupy his mind and he wants to work. But you can see that Ben just doesn't want to have to deal with it. It's just messy and chaotic. And
in that sense, I feel extremely sorry for Leland because, you know, he is supposed to be his business partner. Like, well, I mean, I know he's the lawyer, but like he's supposed to be involved.
Yeah.
And he has like really been cast aside. Like your child has died. We've all been to the funeral. And now, as I was saying before, life goes on.
Yeah.
And very sad, very sad. But we're just going to forget about all your problems.
The other thing to remember, though,
dastardly deeds to be getting on with.
It's been 5 days.
I know.
You know, I mean, so it is insane of him to try and.
It's really insane.
You know, so.
And it's insane for them to have stopped caring.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what. I don't know, you could question whether Ben ever did, but I think one of the themes of this episode is there are so many characters who are not being listened to.
Yeah.
Or who aren't being given time.
Yeah.
And are being pushed aside. But we see them searching Jacques Renault's apartment. I've always loved, I know you don't like this turning into a quote fest, but there's some delicious pieces of writing here. And it's worth mentioning that this episode is a solo Mark Frost effort. And in some ways, this is the most Mark Frost episode because what it does is it complicates the plot, but also it tries to make sense of Lynchian weirdness. Like there's a whole bunch of moments in this where moments from dream sequences are kind of attempted to be given earthly explanations.
Mm.
And that's such a Mark Frost thing. But Mark Frost is
like
also...
Like the red curtains.
Yeah, exactly. And there's always music in the air, you know. And I think that one of the things that Mark Frost does really well, aside from just, you know, writing plot, is he's really good at writing memorable dialogue that fits the characters. Like, I love the bit where Cooper walks into Jacques' apartment and he's talking to Truman and he's like, oh, you didn't sleep well? And Cooper's like, no, there is a large group of insane men on my floor. Always love the way he phrases that. They find Fleshworld. I don't think I ever fully understood this plot element before, but I like the idea that there, because Fleshworld isn't just a pornographic magazine, it's a rendezvous magazine, it's a swingers magazine, basically.
Yeah.
But what the magazine does is it's a third party, so to protect people, they write into the magazine and then the magazine will forward it on, so nobody has anybody's address, so it's safe. But when you think about it, that's absolutely the perfect mechanism to do dodgy business through.
Yeah, of course.
Because you've got no one central repository of information, but now Truman and Cooper have tapped into that line of communication, they can actually start to figure out what's going on.
It's the old school version of the dark net.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love as well how much Cooper, we've talked about this before, how much Cooper enjoys people. Like when he's opening the magazine, he's like, let's see what's inside. He opens it up and you can see him staring. He's not even looking at the magazine. He's staring at Truman because he just wants to get his reaction and sort of enjoy his reaction to it.
Yeah.
We see Bobby and Shelley plotting against Leo, and Norma goes to talk to Ed about Hank as well. And it's funny because we've talked before about how, in some ways, Ed and, I mean, Norma, normal. You know, it's almost like she's the most, probably the most grounded character in the entire show.
Yeah.
Like, she's the most unaffected by the Twin Peaksiness of everything.
She's just trying to get on with the life.
And I don't think her character in any of the shows or the movies directly encounters any of the otherworldly weirdness of the show. Like, she just exists in the real world. And I kind of like that, the idea that you've got all this mad, you know, mythic folklore and stuff going on, and she just wants to run a business and be with the man she loves. She doesn't give a shit about any of this other stuff that's going on.
She is unaffected by that. Shelley and Bobby, honestly, for two people that are scared of Leo catching them together, they spend a lot of time shagging at her house.
Yeah, well, it's the limited sets. And also, they want to create a sense of drama as well.
I know, but it's like, fuck's sake, people, I'm on edge the whole time you two are lounging around in your fucking bathrobes.
And it's funny as well, because every so often, Bobby will say, like, oh, I've got to get back to school. And I'm like, oh, yeah, you're a high school kid. Yeah. It's like, because you forget.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, oh, yeah, yeah, you're whacking school.
I just realised that I would just really not be cut out for that life. Like, I would be have broken out into stress eczema within about the first 15 minutes of having that kind of affair.
It's too much work, isn't it?
Way too much work.
It's the life of the young. During the scene with Ed and Norma as well, I mean, Ed mentions, says to her, look, you know, Nadine's not well. And it's interesting as well, because we've got no context. We've just seen Nadine as this kind of kooky, crazy person for the run of the whole show. But clearly, within the logic of the show, she's taken a turn.
Yeah.
And I like the way that Norma plays it. She's just like, well, oh, you know,
fuck.
We when are we ever going to take something for ourselves?
Yeah.
You know, we're so noble.
Well, no, she's pissed off because she knows that she couldn't do that either. Yeah. She's pissed off with herself as well.
Well, yeah, she's as bad as he is. I mean, she's taken back. But
she's just frustrated about the fact that she knows her own personality and Ed's enough to know that they're never going to leave anyone in the lurch.
Yeah.
It's just not the way they work.
Yeah, they're stuck in a kind of endless cycle as well, aren't they?
Yeah.
One little geeky note as well I've noticed is it's one of the few times we actually get an exterior shot of Horn's department store. And I'm wondering, I don't think they actually filmed that in Twin Peaks because it's not in the pilot, but I've never noticed that before. This is one of those HD revealing it. We see Audrey in with Emery Battis, one of the manager of the perfume counter. Of a department store. And it's interesting as well, Emery Battis was a actor, 1930s screen actor. So it's interesting that they chose to name the character after that. There was a lot of that in the 90s. Mm. Like Max Schreck, one of the characters in Batman Returns, was named after the silent movie actor who played Nosferatu. It seemed to be a kind of an in vogue thing to do at the time. And basically,
Nosferatu is a pretty cool name.
Sorry?
Nosferatu.
And we see Audrey basically shows how manipulative she is by blackmailing Battis into getting her a job there.
Mm-hmm.
We see James and Donna at the lake, and nobody understands James's pain. I bet he'd be terrible to have COVID with, wouldn't he?
Oh, fuck. He can't be any worse than you.
So he talks about his mum.
You really want me to spoon you in front of a window, don't you? While you tell me how hard your life is.
No, on a gazebo, Hannah.
How hard your life is.
Yeah, I feel your pain. So he tells her about his dad who ran off and his mum who's a writer and alcoholic. And we see and this is interesting because when Cooper and Truman are looking at the magazine, they talk about the, Cooper says that must be the place because he's got red drapes because of the dream. And you know, and like I mentioned earlier on, along with sometimes my arms bend back, it's this literal thing. And I think it's interesting because at this point...
See where your mind is, Bap.
but I think that at this point in the series, what Mark Frost is suggesting is the only reason we saw red drapes in Cooper's dream they were a clue for this.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert, there's more to it than that when the show moves forward. But I think at this point in the show, that was probably the case. Mm. It was the fact that everything in that dream was just meant to symbolise something, and Cooper just had to unlock the symbolism and make it literal. And I think that part of the way, the intuitive way that David Lynch and Mark Frost work, the whole idea of ideas appearing from the subconscious and us decoding and finding meaning in them is what the show's about.
Mm.
You know, I don't think you can apply the logic of, oh, well, they just retconned it, or they, I just don't think you can think of it like that. Mm. But it is interesting at this point in the show, seeing that the approach that they've taken to the Red Room is that it's just this symbolically loaded moment that gives clues to things that are going to happen in the show, and how literally the show is taking it as just being that.
Yeah.
As being, this is just Cooper tapping into, using Tibetan method to tap into the collective unconsciousness or collective consciousness, and that's what's happening.
Mm.
And again, you know, there's always music in the air later on, we see as well. It's one of the few times as well in the diner where we actually see music playing in the diner that's realistic to what would be playing in the diner.
And it's not like fucking 100 megawatt loud.
Yeah, it's not weird jazz. It's like kind of fiddle country music.
And it's literally just humming along in the background. Yeah.
So Maddie meets with Donna and James, and I love how much they play this scene, like the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew, right down to the fact that everything's very earnest, and like Maddie's like, oh, it sounds like a secret, and she wants
cherry coke, please.
Cherry coke, you know, it's
the
super
worst of all the drinks.
Yeah, I mean, it reads like a kind of 1950s, you know, young adult kind of teen book.
That's my second leg of beef. She doesn't even take a sip of it.
Oh, that's a common thread in Twin Peaks. There's lots of untouched drinks.
Yeah, it's really annoying. Don't order anything if you're not going to stay for a drink.
I love that Shelley and Norma's day of beauty involves getting beehive.
Shelley especially looks fucking terrible. Yeah, yeah.
It almost feels like they should have like those, you know, the fish bowls in them.
And like Norma's hair, she looks lovely.
But it looks age specific, doesn't it?
Well, no, but her sort of beehive and French roll isn't quite as mad as Shelley.
Oh, okay. So you're actually just judging the quality of the hairmanship. Well,
Shelley's obviously got a lot of thick, curly hair, and they've put it up and so that the two of them have got similar styles, and it really just doesn't fucking suit her hair.
What they should have done is had a male friend go with them, and he should have had it done as well.
It's a bit like in When Harry Met Sally, when Carrie Fisher gets married, and you're supposed to think that she looks amazing, and she looks fucking terrible. Her wedding dress is just awful. But, you know, Sally's busy crying about how amazing she looks, and you're like, she looks like a fucking...
Try your eyes.
Bag lady.
Also, Hank's a slurper, I noticed.
Yeah. I would have been in jail for murdering him.
Yeah. We see the Briggs family therapy as well. We learn that Laura wanted to die. And what is interesting is that what Jacoby gets through to with Bobby, you know, and Bobby's got this whole, you know, the big bad bobcat and all that. But basically what you see is that he's just a boy.
Yeah.
Ultimately. And he's just fronting.
Standing in front of a girl.
And yeah, with a beehive.
And he's to love him.
And
with a gun.
They talk about how Laura had a horrible secret that made her prey on people's weaknesses and corrupt them because she felt corrupted. So what the suggestion is here, and this is kind of the modern sensibility saying this bit here, is that there's clearly a cycle of abuse going on here. What they're describing is very much somebody issuing torment onto somebody because they've been receiving it, you know. And she made him sell drugs at school. Again, I don't know why it would be cocaine, because
in a way it's kind of like, I feel terrible, so everyone around me must feel just as terrible.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And well, and also because she said that every time she tried to be good, she'd get pulled further down into the darkness. So I think her logic seems to be, well, then I'll just go dark.
Just go dark.
Just embrace it, you know?
Mm.
We see the Hawk, Cooper, Truman, and poor Doc Hayward, who's dragged along for some bizarre reason.
I know, with his great big stick.
His stick, going into the woods.
I would like that stick.
And it's funny because we get a little bit more of the slightly racially insensitive Hawk for Tracker, you know.
with the big stick.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, oh, they're coming this way. And I'd be terrible, like in that situation.
But
like,
let's be honest, you'd be lost.
Somebody could have
probably have no pants on.
Yeah.
Hypothermia.
They could have trod in paint and walked through.
A bag of Eton Scroggin in your hand.
No.
Crying because you missed your mother.
Oh, hey. So we see the log lady, or Margaret, as they call her. And the thing is, although I mentioned the whole thing about Hawk, what I like is that it feels like in Twin Peaks, we talked about this before, this idea of modernity and nature and culture and savagery and tribalism and all that kind of stuff, and ancient knowledge. You get the feeling that Hawk and Margaret kind of understand each other.
Yeah.
Like that they are privy to some primal understanding.
Yeah.
And you can be reductive and say that that's a Native American thing, but I think it's larger than that and more general than that. Like they talk about how Margaret's husband, basically the suggestion is that he died in a fire on their wedding night.
Mm.
And she refers to fire, the devil is fire hiding like a coward in the smoke.
Mm.
And she talks a lot about the owls. The owls can't see us in here as well.
Yeah.
And you see Cooper kind of being a bit of a city slicker, like he goes to eat before he's given permission, and he gets reprimanded. And each time you see Hawk kind of smoothing it over and going, oh, you know, you heard something, didn't you, Margaret? And you get the feeling that they know each other.
That's the one thing I would have to say I found out of character for Cooper, because he, you know, he's into the Tibetan rock throwing practices and believing the dreams that come to him from, you know, the lodge and all this kind of thing. The fact that he almost can't suspend his disbelief when it comes to the log lady.
But Cooper is still a modern person.
Yeah.
He's got the dictaphone. Yes. He's got...
But I think given how open he is to so many things, it's interesting that he is quite closed off to her to begin with.
And you see it in an earlier episode as well. Like when she says she asks him to speak to a log and he can't bring himself. It's like as though Cooper's like, hey, even I have like.
Yeah. And like, I think that is a failing of the character.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he should be open to that. He's open to everything else. They should. There shouldn't be that ambiguity there with her.
Yeah.
I do think that's a failing of the writing there.
I disagree. I think that shows shading with the character, because there are a lot of things that Cooper is cynical about, and you see it more as the show goes on. And part of it is that there's a suggestion that there's a little bit of hubris with Cooper as well, because if you look at the Tibetan thing...
Hubris.
If you look at the Tibetan thing, that was a very kind of fashionable... New agey thing at the time.
Yeah.
So I get the feeling that there's a suggestion that Cooper is open to these things, but within his own little realm. It's a little bit like when you hear Catholics say that Scientologists are crazy because they believe in this alien guy, and it's like, well, you believe in like this super Jesus person, you know.
So, super Jesus.
I don't think that's a failure in the writing. I think that's a choice.
Right.
With the character. And I think it's something that you see more of as the show goes on. And it is shown as being something that kind of undoes Cooper a little bit.
Yeah.
Or
maybe point some of those out to me as we get further in. To me, it kind of, I would have to say that's the one thing that I haven't set, that hasn't sat well with me.
Yeah, and I think part of it is...
Not, like, and I say that in a... It's not terrible. It's just, I guess it's the only time that I've felt pulled out of the writing.
Yeah, but I just think that it's that Cooper's openness to spirituality comes from a very modern New Age place, whereas Hawke's and Margaret's comes from something old. And I think there is a division there. Like, you even see after Laura's funeral, when Cooper and Hawke are having that conversation, and Hawke's talking about the dream soul, and Cooper's just like hearing all this for the first time and kind of wide-eyed about it, because that's not part of his...
Yeah, but even then, like, he's wide-eyed when it comes to Hawke, but he's disbelieving when
But ultimately, he does go with it. He does ask for Log.
Yeah, because Hawke has kind of given it his seal of approval. It's almost like he thinks the Log Lady's the fucking crazy.
But I don't think necessarily that Hawke believes in the Log. It's like you see, like Truman looks bemused, and Truman obviously knows about the Log Lady. And he's even more cynical than Cooper about all of the Cooper stuff. So I get the feeling with the Log Lady is that nobody, even I think Hawke, certainly not Truman, believed that her Log, I think they believed that she saw something or heard something on the night. And Hawke knows her well enough to know that they have to play her game. And if they want to hear what she heard, then they have to hear quotes, doing air quotes now for the listeners, what the Log heard. In the same way that, like, she's like a child. Like, you know how when a child has a tea party and they're like, no, you've got the wrong cup, and they kind of lord over it? That's what that scene feels like. She is filmed like a child running a tea party, and she's got all these rules, and, you know, she slaps Cooper's hand, and it's like they're all kind of nicely tolerating her to get to the information that she's got. Of course, we as the audience are wondering whether there's any logic to this, but I don't think there's anything in the scene by the end of it to show that anybody there actually believes that her Log saw something. I think that maybe they believe that she was driven insane by the death of her husband and has replaced him with a piece of wood, and that they've got to kind of feed into that psychosis to get the actual useful information that she's got. I think that could be it. But I don't know. I just think there's a lot going on in that scene. And I think that the figure of the Log Lady is an interesting one, because she's never unambiguously done. But without spoiling anything, I like that the third season, Twin Peaks The Return, goes back to the relationship between Hawke and her.
Yes.
And that's nicely done.
That's really well done.
Future Uzzy's problem. So she was expecting them. They have tea first, and this is where I've got a note about, she's like a kid controlling a tea party. And the day after the wedding, you know, fires the devil hiding like a coward in the smoke. She says that there were two men and two girls, and then there was a third man. And that she again, references to the owls. We hear Into the Night by Julie Cruz playing in the woods, and it leads into the cabin where there's always music in the air, and they find Waldo and some blood. And some of Finley's fine twine as well. And
the poker chip with the piece missing.
So lots of the iconography of Twin Peaks all in one place. Go to the Icelandic party. I love the way that Catherine Martell announces herself as Catherine Martell and spouse. Yeah. When she's got the with her. And I've always loved the way that when Pete says to go, you know, go easy on the sauce, she immediately downs two glasses of champagne and then just wanders on and causes a scene as well. And I've got to say, one of the things I'm really noticing on this rewatch is how good Richard Beamer is as Ben Horn.
Yeah.
The amount of just funny little bits of business he does with his face.
Yeah.
And you can tell he's a classic Hollywood actor. He just knows how to work with the camera.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, in a way that I think only people from that sort of era would. Or, no, especially from that era would.
Her dancing with, I'm rushing ahead, the slaps.
Yeah, yeah. They look real as well.
I love those slaps, and I love the fact that Ben has absolutely no reaction to it.
Yeah, like, he's used to it.
But, it, like, there's not even any pain registering.
Yeah. And you get the impression with Ben Horn, is that he doesn't even care about the outcome. He just lives for the subterfuge.
Yeah.
He just loves the game.
Yeah, and he is a chaos merchant.
And I love the way when Audrey's watching them and all that, and they have the big kiss. And I love the way at the very end of the scene, he's just like, breath mint. It's like, charming.
Yeah.
And when
they return to the party and he tells Catherine to go and dance with, what's his face?
Leland.
Oh, my God. Like, her dancing when she's tapping her head when he's, like, losing his mind. That's what I remember. It's one of those things that I always think about when if someone mentions Twin Peaks, I think of her tapping her head, dancing around the floor and making everyone else start tapping their head as well. It's like one of those lasting memories for me.
It's a core memory. It's funny as well because it's like it's a classic Twin Peaks chaos scene in the way that you've got Leland losing it. You've
like
got the,
legitimately losing
you,
his
you've
shit.
Got like the humour of the misunderstanding around the dance. And then you've got the kind of the dichotomy of Audrey crying. You've got all of this stuff that just doesn't belong together.
Yeah.
Kind of like, and certainly didn't belong together on television.
Yeah.
You know, where one of the things about TV,
so well done,
particularly back then, is you knew how you were meant to feel. You know, the music, the performance, you know, the laugh track on some shows would literally be telling you, this is how you are supposed to
this
feel about
this.
This
should be happy
and this is, I mean, to use a 21st century term, this show's very disruptive in the sense that it's kind of deliberately trying to disorient you about how you're supposed to feel. I also love that Pete's drinking a pint of milk.
Yeah.
When they're there. So we see Maddie sneak a phone call, and this is what we did back before we had, you know, instant
messenger.
She's
the worst sneaker in the world.
Sorry?
Why would you turn the light on?
And we hear a bit of noise and a bit of confusion. There's always just this sense of what a horrible place the Palmer House would be to
be
staying.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to be
staying there. Sort of house of nightmares, that is. And she talks about the bedpost and the tape. Ben sees Josie, and Ben seems to have double-crossed Catherine, has told Josie where the extra ledger was hidden.
Yeah.
We see Hank batter Leo as well. What this thing that we were talking about earlier on, this idea that there's just layer upon layer of power and subterfuge and lies and mystery, as we're seeing in the stuff with Josie and the stuff with Hank. But also, there are so many, and this happens in Fire Walk with me and in Twin Peaks Season 3 as well, there are so many, quote, tough guy characters who we only believe are tough guys because we're told they are.
Yeah.
Because Leo and Hank just don't look like tough guys.
No, well, one sucks a domino.
Well,
and the
Leo
other one's
looks
got
like
the worst ponytail of all time.
The bass player in a hair metal band. And Hank just looks like a friend of my dad's when I was growing up or something, you know. And but when you accept it, you're like, okay, Leo's a real badass. And oh, Hank's an even bigger badass because he beat that badass up. And it's just, you just
he
kind of go
with
it. He
sucks a domino and speaks in a kind of menacing way.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, you know, you don't do that and you're not a badass.
Still looking for a slinky.
Yeah, yeah. So we see Leo go in and kick off at Shelley and she shoots him. I love that his reaction is anger.
Yeah.
He's like, ah! Oh! It's like, God, actually, okay. You're selling it now, you know, for a hair metal bass player. We see the singing start up again in the hotel, just as you see Cooper sort of tiptoeing, like, oh, I've got away with it. And then he's like, oh, God, no, they've started up again. And he walks into his room and sees that Audrey is there, still upset.
Well, he sees that his room is unlocked and
yes,
he thinks someone's broken
in. Yeah, and he says, turn the light on.
Yeah.
And he's left with a sexual dilemma.
Yeah.
And then we close. So any final thoughts, Hannah, before we wrap up for the evening and hopefully move on to our COVID-free lives?
There is so much good stuff to come. I'm just very keen to pick up the pace somewhat.
Yeah, that episode flew by, didn't it?
Yeah, I feel like we need to record another one fairly swiftly.
Yeah. Hey, let's just concentrate on getting this one out first,
because
that hasn't happened yet.
But I don't think we should wait for any length of time for feedback and things. I think maybe we just record the next one when we're ready.
Okay.
Because, you know, the good thing about Twin Peaks is when you get in a momentum with it, it only enhances it. So I just want to get on that crazy train.
Yeah, it's kind of, I think because Twin Peaks is such a dream, it breaks the spell a little bit if you go too long. I think without you, it's good to stay in that kind of bubble.
Yeah, absolutely.
A little bit. But whilst you look up the details for the next episode, I will just do a quick bit of housekeeping, to tell you to send us feedback at rewatchprojectpodcast@gmail.com.
Get on it, people.
And comments on YouTube are also appreciated and will be read out as feedback if it feels appropriate to do so. And you can also reach out to us on Instagram and Twitter, where in both cases we are at rewatchproj. Reviews, preferably 5-star on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and your podcaster of choice, are also greatly appreciated, as is the checking out of our friend shows as well. So do that. And what are we talking about next time, Hannah?
The next episode is called Realization Time. Audrey cons her way into working at the perfume counter where Laura worked and discovers that it's being used as a recruitment post for One-Eyed Jax. James, Donna and Maddie plan to lure Jacoby away from his office. It is directed by Caleb Deschanel and written by Harley Payton.
All righty, looking forward to that. And that is it for now, and we will speak to you soon. Goodbye.
Bye.